standing upright, facing me and clutching her datapad in her usual professional pose, but the paperwork she had been looking at was now strewn all over the floor. It had been flung with such force that some sheets were still drifting around the room like large rectangular snowflakes. "Mr. McKeown," said Warden, with a dangerous quaver in her monotone voice. The datapad was shaking. "Miss Warden?" I noticed that, with no actual conscious thought on my part, I had put up my hands in a surrender gesture. "I appreciate that I have made life difficult for you." She framed each syllable carefully, as if navigating a verbal minefield. "But both of us are mutually trapped in this extremely dangerous situation, and your smug sarcasm is not helping." I felt the switch in my head turn back the other way. My hands dropped. "I nearly got plying lynch because of you, and trapped in a cave. All you had to do was make a sexy video, which you put way more effort into than was necessary, by the way. I wasn't even being sarcastic. Why would you think I was..." My monologue switched tracks mid-journey as I read the minuscule changes in her expression. "Is this promotion not a thing we like? Why wouldn't a promotion be good? It's got pro right there in the word." Somewhat softened, in the sense that quartz is somewhat softer than diamond, Warden looked away. "Henderson has made me a divisional head." "Yeah, well done you. He made Brian Pritchard a divisional head too." I was still trying to read her face, but she had reined her emotions back in, and it was like trying to make a picture out of a particularly nondescript cloud. "And we don't like Brian Pritchard?" "Brian Pritchard was my predecessor as Mr. Henderson's assistant. Just under a year ago, he began serving 19 consecutive life sentences." "So no, then." Warden sat gently back down onto the mattress and stared at the papers splayed across the carpet. "The UR's current government have been making a concerted effort to combat corruption. Since they came into power, there have been several high-profile investigations into the Henderson organization's activities," she said. "Each time, all incriminating evidence has mysteriously led to only one of the company divisions. Each time, the head of that division has taken full responsibility. Each time, Mr. Henderson's lawyers have convinced the jury that Henderson himself knew nothing about it. It has been a continuous pattern. He now refers to the process as the naughtyectomy." "Ah," I said, understanding at last. "And I take it that Henderson is actually more closely involved than the official record states." She passed over one of the loose pieces of paper. "Look at this." It was a rather poor-quality satellite picture of a bubble city. I didn't immediately recognize it on sight, but the tacky pseudo-Arabian Nights architecture gave it away. It was New Dubai, the colony on the desert moon Sigma-14D. At the bottom was some writing in a red spidery hand. "P. Investigate potential market for all the incredibly illegal things we sell. Mr. H." Then he had drawn a little smiley face. "This is why Mr. Henderson has given me these instructions in a non-electronic format. All of these papers are going to be burned." "Not necessarily. You could..." "No, McKeown, they are. They are going to be burned because I am going to burn them. Mr. Henderson will instruct me to, and Mr. Henderson's instructions must be carried out." I leaned on the doorframe, arms folded. "Mr. Henderson also instructed you to employ the real Jacques McKeown for his son's birthday, but you actually haven't. You got one over him there." She glared at me, "and along with the video shoot, that knowledge is why I did not sleep last night." I raised a finger. "Hang on. So you've only been Henderson's assistant for less than a year?" She looked a little ill. "Henderson has never had an assistant for more than a year. I only found that out after I was promoted. Before then, I mainly looked after Daniel's affairs. Henderson handpicked me from the administrative team of his corporation and..." "Whoa!" I interrupted, swapping my raised finger for a raised hand. "What do you mean you looked after Daniel's affairs?" She reddened and looked at the floor, shifting her weight. Daniel had been falling behind at school, and Henderson. I was looking for a way to rise closer to the inner circle. I didn't know the full extent. Oh, go forth and multiply, I breathed, wide-eyed and grinning. That is beautiful. You were the plying nanny. She stiffened, rage flashing in her eyes. I was not a nanny. I was a tutor and a personal assistant. From the hidden speakers in the ceiling there came the sound of a string quartet, experiencing a momentary burst of loud enthusiasm, followed by Daniel's voice. This is your captain speaking, he said, his mock professional tone wavering with barely contained excitement and impatience. Would star pilot Jacques Bicquiard please report to the bridge for space adventure time? I sighed contentedly. Well, little Lord Dointelroy is calling. Let's talk about this later. As I unfolded my arms and turned to leave, the zip fastener on my open flight jacket brushed my holstered blaster pistol, rattling audibly. Warden glanced up just in time to see me holding my jacket closed in about the most obvious way possible. Her eyebrows went up, first one, then the other. Mr. McKeown, is that a gun? I thought quickly. It probably wasn't worth trying to deny it, so I went the opposite direction. Yeah, I said beratingly, as if she'd merely asked me if I was wearing trousers. I held my jacket open, then snapped my fingers to signal realization. Oh, I know what you're worried about. Don't fret, it's only a blaster pistol. See? Energy-based. Won't leave stray projectiles knocking holes in the hull. Anyway, like I said, I'm needed on the bridge, so I'll see you later, bye. Then I turned smartly around and walked away, crossing my fingers and hoping to God that she dropped the matter. It had always been the best technique for getting out of awkward conversations with Mum. Chapter 10. The bridge was grandiose, of course. It was a circular chamber within the largest front-facing observation bubble, with a magnificent captain's chair in the centre, artistically realised entirely in curved lines and silvery mock leather. In front of it was a complicated-looking horseshoe-shaped console, about 50 times larger than it needed to be. A cursory glance on my way across the room revealed that the console had little to do with controlling the actual ship and seemed mainly concerned with disco lighting effects and adjusting the backrest.
"Is this, like, the best ship you've ever piloted?"
asked Daniel proudly, gazing at me from over his illuminated control panel. I rotated in my chair and looked down at my own controls before answering. There was a two-joystick steering system, and every other function was controlled by a touchscreen in between. No pedals, no gauges, no separate controller for externals. I had to flip through three menu screens on the touchscreen to find the controls for the weapon countermeasures. There might as well have been a button that unrolled red carpets for boarding parties. Well, it suits my purposes, I said guardedly. Daniel beamed. Are we ready for takeoff?
Oh, not yet.
He pressed one of the illuminated buttons in front of him and leaned a little too close to a nearby mic.
Prepare for takeoff,
he shouted, before sitting back and grinning at me expectantly. I drummed my fingers on my station. That was it, was it?
Did I do it all right?
Yeah, textbook. I turned back to my touchscreen, checked the external cameras to make sure the bay was clear, and activated the engine. The ship lurched forward as an apparently slightly poorly angled takeoff jet belched into life, and I narrowly escaped gouging my eyes out on the two joysticks. Then the landing legs rapidly withdrew into their housing, like startled trapdoor spiders, and the ship lurched the other way. I wrestled with the sticks until the angle was somewhat corrected, and the ship bobbed clumsily on a cushion of thrust like a fat person trying to get comfortable on a beanbag chair.
Wow, breathed Daniel appreciatively. Listen to that engine purr, like a cat.
If there was anything about this ship that was like a cat, it was its willingness to do as it was told. Not the engine, which was greedily consuming about three times as much fuel as a ship this weight would realistically need, projecting the energy from the thrusters the way an overfed pig projectile vomits swill back into the trough. It climbed up into the sky in the manner of an overweight cherub with undersized wings, correcting its course with the occasional well-timed fart. Daniel was enjoying the view of the city, sitting proudly upright like a benevolent overseer. I set a wobbling course for the airlock at the very apex of Ritsuko's plexiglass dome, which reminded me that we needed to call in for clearance. I eventually found the communications tab, after several touchscreen swipes and pop-up advertisements, and hailed the upside-down control tower. Golf Whiskey Sushi 00901 calling Apex Tower, I said in my professional voice, requesting exit to Big Black, over. Apex Tower to Golf Whiskey Sushi, exit request acknowledged, came the tower controller's voice. Stand by, your vessel will be scanned. I was chummy with a lot of ground control and tower boys, since we'd all been thrown on neighbouring track heaps after quantunnelling came about, so I had a pretty good idea what was coming next. I took a deep breath and waited. Apex Tower to Golf Whiskey Sushi. Seriously? Over. I let the deep breath out again. Golf Whiskey Sushi to Apex Tower. Don't worry, it's not mine. Over. Exit granted. Opening internal airlock access. Have fun with the pirates, and with explaining the blaster damage to whatever plying fat-headed rich bracket you're flying that thing for. Over and out. I risked a look back at Daniel while the ship was in the airlock and we were waiting to be cycled out through the inner and outer doors. He was still watching me with a huge, excited smile on his face, like a dog on their first car trip, before they've come to associate such things with the vet.
"That was so cool how you were talking just then," he said, jiggling up and down. "All that star pilot banter, it was like actually being in one of your books. Hey, do you think after the trip we could go to one of your star pilot bars and meet all your drinking buddies?"
I tried to picture how that would turn out. An underage client walking into somewhere like the Brandied Bracket and announcing that it's okay, he's being accompanied by his friend Jacques McKeown. My mind's eye was suddenly flooded with shoe leather. "No offence, Daniel, but I'm only being paid to fly."
"Oh, sure, that's cool. You can just drop me off at Dad's new place when we're done, and then I can tell him all about the time I had."
That was the first time I began to wonder exactly how many layers of intellect I was up against. What game were Daniel and I playing here? Poker or guess who? When the outer airlock was open, I took the God of Whale Sharks upward, and I was almost lurched out of my chair again when we escaped the effects of Ritsuko's artificial gravity field. Once I'd killed the thrusters and jiggled the joysticks into line, the ride became comparatively responsive. The ship certainly benefited from being in zero gravity. Now all it needed was 6 or 7 weeks' work by a team of men with angle grinders. Below us, Luna seemed a lot smaller, especially with the Earth hanging directly overhead like a yellow disco ball. The black infinity on all sides gave the usual dizzying vertigo for a second. I took my customary moment to meditate on it, then began plotting a course. That ran into an immediate roadblock. "So you haven't told me where you actually want to go," I said.
"Ooh, we should go to Earth first."
I turned and looked at him again. "I was under the impression you were after a more exotic adventure than the place where you live."
"Oh, we just need to make a quick stop, it's cool."
"I can't land on Earth, I haven't got the paperwork," I revealed. "I can't get the paperwork without 6 months of background checks, and they've got a lot of tricky legislation for people trying to land unauthorized." "Tricky legislation is the name they have for surface-to-air missiles."
"No, it's cool," said Daniel,
cool being the default position of the entire universe, apparently.
"We don't have to land, we just need to pick up one of my, friends in Cloud Castle. You can just fly as close to Earth, and I can use the quantunnel booth."
Cloud Castle. I'd heard rumours about it. An exclusive gated community for the ultra-rich residents of the United Republic, attached to a point halfway up one of the space elevators they used to get workers up to the satellite surveillance network. It made sense that the Hendersons and their friends lived there. The only reason someone with the money to leave Earth wouldn't do so would be if they never had to set foot on the ground. "You can't quantunnel to Earth from orbit," I pointed out. "Earth's quantunnel network doesn't allow off-world transport. It's their law. We'd need to land first."
"Oh." Well, it'll probably be cool if we just landed quickly.
My fingers were drumming on the joystick. I doubt the authorities would see it that way, Daniel.
No, we have to. It's really important. Come on, it's really easy to just quickly land and pick something up and go. Dad's friends do it all the time.
These friends of your dad, I said, do they tend to be burly sorts, in suits, with guns? Because I have a pretty good idea of why they don't get hassled.
Do you want to meet them?
I paused for a moment, digesting this, then rotated 180 degrees in my chair and placed my hands tentatively on the joysticks. Then I made a snap decision and rotated 180 degrees right back. Was that a threat?
What?
I'm not asking in a doint-waving counter-threat kind of way, you understand. I genuinely couldn't tell if it was a threat or not.
No, it wasn't a threat, seriously, said Daniel,
but he kept smiling earnestly. I wasn't prepared to call it. It's fine if it was a threat. I respond well to threats. It clears the air. I just like to have a grip on the situation.
Okay, it was a threat.
Are you only saying that because I said it was fine?
Maybe.
I stared into his wide, trusting, admiring eyes, his big, beaming smile. There was always the possibility that he was on the level, and had been only saying innocent things that I, in my paranoid way, had taken for veiled threats. And even if he wasn't, would Mr. Henderson care that much for Daniel's complaints? How much did he dote on his son? Enough to buy him whatever he asked for, but spending money was something he seemed to do pretty casually. And he didn't care enough to do 30 seconds of research and realize the ship he was buying was total pirate bait. There was a distinct possibility that Daniel did not actually have any power here. Power to have me violently murdered, that is. I placed my hands on the joysticks and sighed. Shall we just stop off on Earth, then?
Yay!
Chapter 11. Thankfully, as paranoid as the United Republic could be about non-Terrans, they were still slightly more paranoid about their own citizens. Almost the entirety of the satellite surveillance network around Earth pointed inward, and it didn't take long to find a gap in the coverage big enough to squeeze even the Platinum God of Whale Sharks through. After that, I was able to mask our presence by hiding in the upper pollution layer. One of the broader societal effects of Quantunling, I'd noticed, is that people became much worse at giving directions. The best Daniel could offer was that Cloud Castle was in the sky somewhere, although Quantunling probably wasn't entirely to blame. Fortunately, a space elevator is a difficult thing to miss, and even with smog reducing visibility to roughly the distance between my face and the tip of my nose, it didn't take long to find the thick silvery blue cable snaking off into the clouds in both directions. Then it was just a matter of hugging close and following it downward. The first sign that we were drawing close to our destination was when the yellow clouds began turning green, then to a rich, healthy blue, apparently due to artificial coloration. The next sign was when the clouds began to thin, and we almost ran straight into an artificial sun, attached to the space elevator with a gigantic steel brace. Past that, we found ourselves in a massive sphere of clear air, apparently maintained by a complicated array of powerful fans that were making a determined effort to use up what energy the planet had left as quickly as possible. In the center of this space was Cloud Castle, and it was clear that, for all the things Mr. Henderson had had to say about bubble colonies, he can't have been completely averse to the concept. Cloud Castle was a network of tightly bunched spherical habitats, clinging to the space elevator like a colossal glass raspberry on a branch. I peered into the domes as we flew past and saw a succession of neatly spaced white houses and perfectly kept green lawns, interspersed with gleaming white surveillance poles, each with row upon row of cameras along its length. As we passed by human figures, lightly dressed in fashionable pastels, their tiny faces turned to look suspicious. Shortly, the cameras began doing likewise. "We're drawing too much attention," I said uncomfortably. "Where's the plying docking bay?"
"Oh, yeah, it's in the middle somewhere," said Daniel.
He made a very strange gesture that involved bending his wrist right back and pointing to something below and to the left of him.
"That way?"
"Thanks," I said, smiling with both rows of teeth. The ship circled the dome cluster like a mosquito who'd shown up at an orgy and was trying to decide which buttock to sample first. We must have been spotted by every resident in the place by the time I noticed a set of bay doors in the roof of a small white dome marking the nexus of six large habitats. The ship hovered close to the doors, and my hand hovered over the communicator as I concocted a lie to tell the ground control people. If I could come up with something that would get us inside, I could figure it out from there. The never-fail method was to put on the falsetto voice and claim to be going into labour, but that tended to be overkill. The bay doors began to open, sliding apart like the jaws of a Venus flytrap. I hadn't even sent a hail signal yet. I glanced back, but it seemed like Daniel hadn't either, not unless he was in the habit of keeping a communication device up his nose. It didn't seem like a friendly welcome. It reminded me more of a sleeping bear, lazily opening one eye as a much smaller animal attempted to sneak past. And now it was scrutinizing me, and trying to decide if it was in the mood to get up and start mauling. Still, it was an opportunity. I maneuvered the ship carefully inside the circular hangar, and came in to land on one of the many unoccupied parking bays. There was only one other ship, another luxury yacht, slightly more understated than ours, with the gleaming sheen of a vessel that was very frequently cleaned but very rarely flown. The residents of Cloudcastle clearly had few reasons to travel anywhere else. Nobody came out to greet us, but we hadn't been shot down by surface-to-air missiles, which was a plus. I'd probably have been immediately blown out of the air if I'd shown up in the Never Die. The obvious pointless decadence of the Platinum God of Whale Sharks had earned us the benefit of the doubt. I watched the bay doors ominously slide closed, then my touchscreen drew my attention with a pop-up window and a little beep. The Quantinal booth's connected to the local network, I reported. So who is this person we're picking up again? I heard the sound of aluminium foil being crinkled, and turned to see Daniel standing up out of his chair, straightening his jumpsuit and brushing off imaginary dust.
"It's just a friend," he said.
"Look, if you're bringing one of your dad's toughs aboard to menace me around, just say so." He smiled, baffled.
"What?"
He was adjusting the clasp on his chest as a man in a tuxedo would adjust his bow tie. It'd honestly be a relief at this point. I know where I stand when I'm under a henchman's shoe.
Said Daniel, uncomprehending. "I'm just going to go and get her. I'll be literally 1 second."
Then he ran off, leaving me with my advancing worries. "Her," I repeated, in the confines of my own head. The plot thickened. I wasn't immediately relieved, though. No reason to assume Mr. Henderson wouldn't have female henchmen, just as willing and able to put their shoes on my face as the men. I was startled from these thoughts by a burst of energetic violin music coming from my console. The touchscreen flashed with the words, "Incoming call, Cloudcastle Ground Control." Glancing up, I looked through the viewscreen at the interior wall of the docking bay, in the upper half of which was a wide viewing window. Two sets of head and shoulders were visible, silhouetted against severe fluorescent lighting. The shoulders were either wearing big epaulettes or hunched up with anal retention. My hand hovered over the receive call button. It was probably safe to assume that Terran ground control wouldn't be as easygoing as their Lunarian counterparts. For one thing, I didn't know them personally, and couldn't blackmail my way through with knowledge of late-night drinking indiscretions. Fortunately, I wasn't trying to gain entry. I only needed to stall them until Daniel returned with whatever fresh hell he had prepared for me. That gave me the advantage. Stalling bureaucrats is easy. Half the time they stall themselves without you even having to ask. But failing that, the best technique is to pretend to be extremely stupid. I got into character by slackening my jaw and staring boggle-eyed at the touchscreen as I mashed the receive button with a knuckle. "Your vessel has been scanned," came a pompous voice. "One or more of your crew members are lacking the necessary permissions for entering or landing upon United Republic territory." I found myself wondering when it had gone out of fashion to refer to it as Planet Earth.
"Hello," I replied,
lowering the pitch of my voice an octave and talking like my tongue had grown 3 sizes larger. Entering United Republic territory without valid permissions is grounds for immediate detention and interrogation under the Prevention of Terror Act, continued the official.
What?
I slurred, leaning into the touchscreen as if I didn't know that the mic was incorporated into the headrest of my chair. If you do not submit valid permission documents, immediate action will be taken. I waited for roughly the amount of time it would take an average person to start wondering if I'd hung up, then repeated,
"What?"
A pause. State whether you are the captain or the pilot of this vessel.
"Do you want to speak to the captain?"
I spoke as slowly and loudly as possible, enunciating as if I'd been taught to speak on a consonant-per-year basis.
"He was here a moment ago."
"State whether you are the captain or the pilot of this vessel." The tone was completely unchanged.
"Why do you keep saying the same things? Are you stupid?"
I was deliberately trying to provoke frustration, partly to aid with the stall, and partly out of curiosity about whether there was anything remotely close to a human being behind that voice. "Please identify yourself immediately," it said, which did nothing to resolve the debate. Failure to comply will...
"I don't think I can help you. You should talk to the captain," I said. "Could you hold for a minute while I find him? I think this is the hold button."
Then I hung up. I leaned back and placed my feet up on the console, crossing my ankles. Elegant little play, the idiot routine. It gets the target frustrated, but not confrontational frustrated. The kind of frustration aimed mainly at yourself, and your lack of patience for the disadvantaged. They'd probably call back, but it might not be for a while. First there'd be however long it took for them to realize that they were not on hold after all, but were waiting patiently on a disconnected line. They might call back immediately at that point, but chances were good they'd double-check the scans, make some effort to contact someone else, or initiate some other time-wasting bureaucracy that meant they wouldn't have to attempt to communicate with me again. The steel rods holding the docking bay access door closed suddenly slammed aside with such unnecessary violence that the clang was audible from my cockpit. I started, failed to disentangle my ankles, and fell right off my chair. By the time I'd gotten my legs sorted out and gotten back into a position to see outside, the bay's access door had just completed the final part of the rather technical, multi-stage opening sequence. A small team of 8 armed men, decked out with black body armor and concussion rifles designed for use in riot control, jogged into the docking bay with military choreography. I watched, open-mouthed, as they trooped underneath the ship and out of sight, presumably making for the external airlock door. What the hell kind of spaceport has a plying SWAT team ready for deployment in case there's a momentary issue with the paperwork? What the track kind of terror threat were these measures designed to combat? Malmined cyberzerkers masquerading as very stupid rich people? From the belly of the ship I heard a short, polite knocking on the external airlock door. This formality over with, it was immediately followed by a harsh pounding of rifle butts. How long would the hull on this decadent pile of track actually hold out? I was starting to feel like the bag of chocolate buttons inside a cheap Easter egg. Subconsciously, my hand had already drawn my blaster from my shoulder holster. Blowing the invading soldiers away wasn't what I'd consider the rational course of action, but the sight of it could at least start a conversation. I scurried out of the bridge and down the 2 sets of carpeted steps to the circular foyer. The inner airlock door was open. I considered closing it, but that would only delay the inevitable and ensure further damage to the ship. A ship could still fly with a smashed-open external airlock door. You just had to make sure you only ever entered or left the ship within an atmosphere. But there'd be no escape with both doors forced open. Not unless everyone on board was prepared to seal all their orifices shut. The external airlock door was still holding, but the wheel lock quivered with greater and greater energy with every hit. I pointed my gun at it, planted my feet, and waited. Hopefully my greeting would expedite matters. Boy, I thought as I waited, it would be so embarrassing for these guys if it turned out I did in fact have the necessary permission papers and could produce them the moment they stormed in. This was not a particularly helpful thought to have. After all, even if I did, they might not necessarily be in the name of Jacques McKeown. And then it hit me. Warden was still on board. She'd convinced the chip ID system that I had the name of a traitorous novel-writing bracket everyone wanted to kill. Convincing the immigration database that I had a visa would probably be a hell of a lot easier. The crew quarters were only one level up. I took the stairs three at a time and shoulder-barged my way into Warden's quarters. She was still sitting on the bed going over Mr. Henderson's paperwork and was startled to her feet by my sudden entrance. "Mr. McKeown, what on earth are you doing? What is that banging noise? Answer both questions." I took a deep breath. "I'm bursting into your quarters waving a gun. Second answer, there are some United Republic immigration staff wanting to see paperwork that I don't have."
"I see."
She sat down again and crossed her legs. "I expect the relationship between the two matters is that you think I can assist in some way."
"Nail on the head. Can you?"
She returned her gaze to her work nonchalantly. "Were I inclined to, yes." I squeezed the grip of my gun. This helped me cope.
"Why wouldn't you be inclined to? Do you know what those drones are going to do when they get in here?"
"I know what they're going to do to me, Mr. McKeown. Absolutely nothing, because I am a citizen of the United Republic and a resident of this community. What they will do to you is capture and interrogate you until you confess to your involvement in anti-Terran terrorism."
The banging noise was getting more sonorous. I got the impression that the team outside had made a decent enough dent on one part of the door and had all started concentrating on that.
"I'm not the slightest bit involved in anti-terrorism. I don't give a track about what Earth does."
"I doubt that fact matters as much to the gentleman outside as meeting the monthly quota for anti-terror operations," said Warden. "As long as your signing hand is still functioning by the end of the week, they may even be able to earn a funding increase."
I tried playing one of the big cards in my hand. "You know Mr. Henderson isn't going to be terribly pleased about his son's special treat being ruined by his hero getting arrested and tortured." She placed a hand on her chin thoughtfully.
"Actually, Mr. Henderson has long borne a grudge against the immigration department. I may be able to shift the blame entirely to them. It can hardly be considered my fault that you failed to apply for the right permissions."
"May," I repeated, triumphantly stabbing a finger at her, as if I were pinning the word to a corkboard.
"You said may. You can't be certain he won't take it out on you."
"And you can't be certain he will. Welcome to your new life, on the ocean of uncertainty that is the Henderson Corporation." She met my gaze, one side of her upper lip stabbing upward in distaste. "I've had to put up with it for a lot longer than you have." My chest deflated, and my arms fell loosely to my sides. My gun brushed my leg like a faithful dog reassuring its downhearted master.
"Back to Plan A, then," I muttered, turning to go.
I stopped in my tracks when a particularly loud clang signaled that the first opening had been created.
"Of course, I would become more inclined to assist if something was offered in return," said Warden with maddening calm.
I reluctantly turned back around as if mounted on a slow, lazy Susan.
"What do you want?"
"Your pistol," she said, nodding toward my dangling hand. "I have been feeling more and more often in the last few days that I need a means of defense."
"Do you even know how to use a blaster?"
"I don't intend to fire it, Mr. McKeown. I would just feel more comfortable with it in my possession." I looked down at my gun. I fancied that it was looking up at me with big brown puppy dog eyes. Below me I heard the whine of bending metal. I reached for one last attempt at reason.
"This gun may be the only defense we'll have if pirates get on board."
"That was precisely my thinking, and the specific pirates I am concerned about are the very recently recruited ones who may or may not already be on board the ship." I gave in. While I wasn't sure what game I was playing with Daniel, I knew exactly which one I was currently playing with Warden. Some hybrid of chess and Russian roulette, and I didn't have the rule book. I toyed briefly with the idea of starting a game of Clue with her in the starring role, then sulkily threw my gun onto the bed. The airlock's exterior door rattled aside with some difficulty, having significantly changed shape since the last time it had opened, and the lead soldier found himself standing in the entryway with his rifle still poised stupidly in mid-smash. Miss Warden's datapad was directly in front of his face, displaying an official-looking certificate with a large and ominous seal. "I am Penelope Warden, Divisional Head of the Henderson Corporation and Registered Notary. Here are my credentials," she said, pausing for the briefest possible amount of time for each comma. "All interactions with my client, Mr. Jacques McKeone, must now go through me. I am his representative for all matters related to his application for asylum." The soldiers leaned in finely honed military unison, to read the small print. With their all-black helmets and shiny black body armour sculpted into the shape of ideal human musculature, they looked like a blackberry bush swaying in the breeze. They were all wearing black balaclavas under their helmets that only exposed the eyes, but those eyes were conveying enough confusion to make up for the rest of the face. "Asylum?" asked the one in front. I was standing behind Warden, trying not to look like a schoolboy getting his angry mother to confront the headmaster. I waved cockily, and some of the gazes turned to me. One of the soldiers, it was hardly worth differentiating them, decided that the best approach to Warden was to pretend she wasn't there. I wished I'd thought of that when we'd first met. "Do you or do you not have the necessary permissions to enter the United Republic?" he asked gruffly, with a menacing glare. Warden immediately sidestepped to intercept it. "My client does not currently possess the necessary permissions. However, United Republic law states that an entrant without permissions may remain in transit regions for a period of 24 hours in order to lodge an application for asylum." The soldiers started grumbling antsily, having psyched themselves up for a bout of skull-cracking that was slipping ever further from their grasp. One of the shrewder pairs of eyes said, "But that's only if he's actually eligible for asylum." Warden was ready for that one. She smartly swiped the certificate on the pad aside to reveal a highlighted section of legal document. "Indeed, United Republic law states that an individual becomes eligible for asylum if there is strong evidence to the effect that their physical well-being is under threat by a ruling authority." "And is it?" "It is. Mr. McKeone is in extreme danger of being physically brutalized by a team of 8 government soldiers for not possessing permission papers." The shrewd one figured it out first. "You mean us?" "The law of the United Republic states only that the threat be created by a ruling authority," said Warden, folding her datapad under her arm and standing fully straight to signal her victory. "It does not state that the ruling authority cannot be its own, and we have all the evidence we need that the threat exists, because I am currently addressing it." The men had been defeated by the very bureaucracy they zealously enforced, and they knew it. They shifted guiltily, looking sadly at their weapons, as if they'd just realized that they'd shown up in tuxedos to a beach party. But then the shrewd bracket started with a realization and threw up an upward-pointing index finger. "Ha! Wait a minute! There's a fault in your logic!" Warden's half-smile of triumph froze. "Is there? You say he's eligible for asylum because we were going to physically assault him, but if we don't physically assault him, then he's not eligible at all, is he?" A moment's absolute stillness, then Warden sighed in irritation through her teeth. "I should have realized. You're right. You are entirely authorized to brutalize Mr. McKeone, as long as you do not brutalize Mr. McKeone." She let that sink in for a moment, the two parties staring at each other across the ship's threshold. The shrewd bracket's shoulders slowly sagged. "Well, he still has to leave," said the team leader. "Absolutely," said Warden. She turned to me. "Daniel's picking up Jemima, I take it?"
"Yeah, possibly. Who's Jemima?"
"Mr. McKeone will be out of your hair within a couple of hours. In the meantime, don't hesitate to leave." She probably intended to remain standing defiant as the door closed in the soldiers' faces, but it got stuck halfway. We stared at each other through the gap for a while before the soldiers quietly walked away, muttering. The one bringing up the rear looked briefly over his shoulder. "We like your books, by the way."
Chapter 12.
It was about an hour before Daniel returned. I used the time to beat the dents out of the exterior airlock door as best I could, which made me quite nostalgic for the days when enemy pilots could actually afford ammunition. The selection of tools available on the ship was, of course, pathetic, so I was using a meat tenderizer I'd found in the breakfast nook. So Warden had figured out that I was planning to cross the Black. Her having my gun was going to make it difficult to maintain control of the ship if I started flying it to suspicious places. But she obviously didn't know me well enough yet if she thought that would make me give in. She herself had made it impossible for me to return to Ritsuko City. I'd just have to take a more delicate approach, or failing that, threaten to beat her to death with my own severed leg. I tried the opening and closing mechanism a few times. It worked relatively smoothly. It wasn't going to be completely airtight, but we still had the internal door, and I probably wouldn't need to do any EVA work. Even if I did, the gap wasn't enormous. It wouldn't suck all the air out of the internal atmosphere if I worked fast. I tested the opening mechanism one more time and saw Daniel at the entrance to the docking bay, accompanied by, presumably, Jemima, who, to my relief, was not the ironically named ex-wrestler bodyguard my imagination had been furnishing, but a girl his age, with bright pink hair and a baggy hoodie matched paradoxically with tight black leggings. "I thought you were coming back in the Quantunnel," I said. Daniel's face was very red, and sweat glistened on his brow. He started a little at my question, having been gazing fixedly at the girl.
"What? Oh, I wanted to show it to her from outside first. It's cool, isn't it, Jemima?"
She was looking over the ship's ample curves.
"So this is yours?"
she asked. Then she glanced nervously over her shoulder at the docking bay entrance. He took a step closer and pretended to appraise the ship, arms folded.
"Yep, that's my ship,"
he said, trying to sound nonchalant, but emphasizing the "my" weirdly.
"I just got my own ship now, no big deal."
I leaned on the doorframe and stared at them. His eyes kept flicking over to her, studying her reaction, but her own gaze was reserved only for switching between the ship and the door by which she'd entered.
"Wouldn't it be, like, really obvious to pirates?"
"That's what I said," I interjected, unable to help myself.
"Is that what happened to the door?"
she asked, nodding shallowly towards the dents.
"Oh, my God," said Daniel, dropping the aloof act. "Did we miss it? Did pirates try to board while we were gone?"
I gave that question the awkward silence it deserved. Not while parked in a docking bay, no. He laughed a little bit too much.
"Oh, yeah, of course. Not while parked."
He coughed, reassembled the aloof look, and pretended to have noticed me for the first time.
"Oh, hey, Jacques, this is Jemima. Jemima, this is my pilot, Jacques McKeown. He's just a friend of mine, you know. Maybe you've heard of him, he's written some books."
Jemima had been watching behind her during most of the introduction, but now gave me her full attention, quickly looking me up and down.
"You're not Jacques McKeown?"
She didn't say it with the tone of one triumphantly revealing subterfuge. It was a matter-of-fact statement, mixed with the slight bafflement of one wondering why no one else has seen what seemed obvious to them. Even so, I jumped and almost lost my balance. "What?" Jemima shrugged.
"Well, you know, the real Jacques McKeown wouldn't come out and fly other people's ships, because he, like, writes books full-time."
Daniel laughed a bit too much again.
"No, really, it's actually the real, actual Jacques McKeown. My dad got hold of him for me."
"Well, your dad was probably, you know, lying to you. Like he did when he said he didn't break Mr. Peterson's legs for giving you a failing grade."
Daniel seemed about to say something, but then fell silent as a thoughtful look crossed his face. Apparently this extremely compelling point had not occurred to him. It was time to flick the switch in my head. I laughed good-naturedly, making a pretty convincing job of it if I do say so myself. "I know how it looks," I said, smiling in a crinkly-eyed favourite uncle kind of way. "But you'd be surprised how little money novels make these days. And a writer's life is never going to be enough for someone who's used to space adventuring, is it?" She touched her chin, looking at me with reassuring uncertainty.
"But..."
The entrance to the docking bay opened noisily, and Jemima almost jumped out of her skin. She let out a sigh of relief when she saw that it was only one of the soldiers, smartly relieving a single member of the armed group that had been watching us vigilantly for the entire hour.
"Hey, can we go inside now?"
she said, with one last look behind her. Daniel beamed at the suggestion, I moved out of the doorway to let them in, keeping an eye on Jemima. I offered a cheery wave to the armed guards, then closed the exterior door. All throughout and following takeoff, Jemima stood over me to watch the scenery from the best spot. But once we were out of Cloud Castle's designated clearing and back in the real clouds, the scenery was swiftly reduced to flat, unbroken yellow, like we were flying through custard.
"So is it like a Santa Claus thing?"
she asked. Most of her jitteriness seemed to have mysteriously evaporated since our departure. "What?" I said.
"You know, like, you're not Jack McKeown, but you're one of Jack McKeown's helpers."
She gave a little twitch at the corner of her mouth, the sort of thing nervous people do that will only turn into a full smile if someone else smiles first. Daniel obligingly burst into another of his desperate, overlong laughs. Of course he was hovering around too. He had to maintain a constant orbit of about 3 feet from Jemima, a little Goldilocks band of his very own, not far enough to separate from her, but not close enough that she might pick up on his incredibly obvious crush. "I am Jack McKeown," I said flatly. I'd been trying to get into the mindset of the real Jack McKeown, and after a couple of dry heaves, I had concluded that he would be pretty testy by this point. Luckily, that would require very little acting.
"No, seriously, he is. Dad checked him out on the ID network, and that was his name," said Daniel, confirming Miss Warden's story.
"Well, that doesn't actually prove it," said Jemima. "Jack McKeown probably doesn't write books under his real name, 'cause all the other pilots want to kill him and stuff. I heard about that on the fan side. It kind of sounds like a name someone made up because it sounds like a pilot-y kind of name."
"Which could easily be the case if the owner of the name's father was a pilot and wanted their son to also be a pilot," I pointed out. This was true of my own dad. He'd been a full-time courier for Speedstar Transport before star piloting officially became a thing, and it's always easier to con people with the truth.
"I guess," said Jemima.
Then,
"Oh, wow!"
Her eyes flew to the view outside. The pollution clouds parted like hideous yellow curtains over a nighttime window, and the platinum god of whale sharks burst back out into the blackness of space, nimbly slipping through the same gap in the surveillance net as before. The infinite spangled emptiness had never looked friendlier. For one thing, it gave me something to distract the passengers with.
"I've never seen stars like that before," breathed Jemima, rapt.
"So what do you think of my ship?"
asked Daniel, brushing some imaginary dust off a section of ornamental railing.
"You think it's so lame, right? My dad picked it out. I told him to get the red one, but he could be so stupid."
"It's really cool,"
said Jemima, deforming her face against the curved plexiglass above and to the right of me.
"Yeah, it is, isn't it?"
said Daniel, changing his tune with the ease and smoothness of a freight train trying to switch tracks while halfway past the junction.
"It cost like $500,000 or something?"
Jemima finally peeled her cheek off the window, leaving a patch of pubescent grease and hair dye.
"What? Oh, yeah, the ship. It's really nice. What are you going to, you know, call it?"
"Call it? Oh, what would you think if I called it the Jemima?"
I felt a surge of regret for having given Warden my blaster, because I had a sudden longing to put the end in my mouth.
"Oh,"
said Jemima awkwardly.
"That's cool."
"Hey," I said brightly, leaping to the rescue, as star pilots tend to do. "Where do you crazy kids want to go, anyway?"
"Oh, yeah,"
said Jemima, relievedly looking away from Daniel's eager face.
"I was going to say, I can't stay out too long. I didn't actually tell my mum that I was going out."
"It's cool, I probably wasn't going to stay out very long either,"
said Daniel hastily.
"Where do you want to go?"
Jemima glanced back at space through the plexiglass, like a diner trying to pick from a menu.
"I'm fine with wherever you want to go."
"I'm literally fine with wherever.
Excuse me," I interjected, before the discussion continued its round trip to nowhere fast. "Did I hear you say you only need me for a few hours?"
"Oh, well, if you want to hang out for longer,"
said Daniel. "No, no, no," I interrupted, nipping that one in the bud immediately. "It's fine. I was just under the impression that I was being contracted for a few days here."
"Not all in one go,"
he said, nonplussed.
"It's a school night. I was just going to take a, you know, test drivey thing, and then you can drop us off, and Dad can call you in at the weekend sometime."
"Yeah, that should work out. My mum's usually away at weekends," said Jemima quietly.
A little shoot of hope sprouted forth from the black bean of my internal mood. Drop them off? As in, they're not even going to supervise me taking the ship back to the Yubatsu building? I could have crossed the black and been safely surrounded by fellow pirates before the night was over. And bringing them the platinum god of whale sharks might even buy me a spot in a top bunk right off the bat. There was still the matter of Warden. But maybe she'd want to be dropped off somewhere too. If she didn't, I could always drop her off in one way or another. Track, I thought, that was a dark thought out of nowhere. "Well, how about just a tour of the solar system, then?" I said aloud, lent energy. "A flyover of Saturn's rings is something you have to do once in your life. Hell, you're still young, let's do it twice for kicks."
"That sounds awesome," said Jemima, not looking away from the view.
"Awesome, yeah," parroted Daniel.
Then he felt confident enough to move an inch closer and initiate a bout of hover-handing. I set a course for Saturn, gunned what passed for the main thruster, and gripped the joysticks with a silent sigh of relief. There was something very pleasing about not having to kidnap the two children. Even disregarding the complications it would have created, I'd be plied if I wasn't starting to like the little brackets. Daniel was still a little doint, obviously, but the knowledge that he had partially been doing all of this to impress a girl sort of recontextualized him a bit. There was a certain pathetic lovability about it, like a dog holding its bowl in its mouth. And Jemima's reaction to seeing space had made me feel a little warm inside. My first gaze into the abyss had been similar, and it was something I saw so rarely these days, now that people thought they could get the experience just as well from immersion simulators, or by going out onto their roof garden in the middle of a quiet night and looking up. We flew past Luna, glancing briefly at the lights of Ritsuko City, under the colossal plexiglass shell that the moon wore like a sparkling monocle. Jemima remained by my side, hypnotized by the stars, so of course Daniel stuck around, fidgeting with his fingers. In contrast, I don't think he'd looked out of the window at all since Jemima had come aboard. His attention alternated between being focused entirely on her and combing his fingers through his highlighted forelock. Experience transporting tourists had taught me that the scenery tends to get samey very fast, and right on cue, Jemima resumed the discussion, after Luna was behind us and the view was awash with blackness again.
"So are you really truly Jacques McKeown?"
she asked, turning and half-perching on my console.
"He totally is,"
answered Daniel on my behalf.
"I bet he can't prove it," she said.
She seemed more excited, bobbing on her heels and clasping her hands.
"Ask him something about the books. Something, you know, only Jacques McKeown would know."
"I will, okay, in what book?"
An alarm sounded. My touchscreen started flashing red, and the console in front of the captain's chair gibbered urgently. A few crucial seconds were lost as I navigated the swipe menus looking for the damage report, then I clicked my tongue. "One of the rods in the engine compartment isn't cooling."
"Is it supposed to?"
asked Jemima, eyes wide. I stood up. "Well, considering that they're cooling rods, yes. Don't worry, this is pretty common. 9 times out of 10, it's just misaligned. I'll be gone about half an hour to fix it. Daniel? Jemima?" I put a hand on one shoulder for each of them. "I need you to step up for me. I won't be long, but if any more red lights come on, I need you to stay calm, be strong, and let me know as soon as possible. Can you do that?" Daniel's chest swelled.
"Yes, sir."
Jemima nodded. "Good. Stay here." I jogged out of the bridge, then slowed immediately to a walk when I was confident that I was out of sight. There was no reason to start worrying until at least 5 of the cooling rods were down. On top of that, I knew perfectly well why the rod had deactivated, because I had told it to. Every time I started work with a new ship, I made a point of learning the quickest way to make an alarm go off that doesn't actually damage the ship. It was always handy to be able to manufacture myself a coffee break on short notice. And on this occasion I had to swiftly reacquaint myself with Jacques McKeown trivia before the grilling continued. I headed for the reading room. I wouldn't be able to read all of the plying things, but I had a familiarity with the events in the books, mainly because most of the bitter conversations I'd had in the brandied bracket drifted to the topic of which McKeown books ripped off whose stories. I just have to hope that giving the titles and the blurbs a quick once-over would give me enough to bull-track with. I met Warden in the corridor outside the reading room, and she followed me in like a cat hanging around expecting to be fed. "What was that alert sound?" she demanded. I made a beeline for the bookshelf. "Minor engine fault," I said casually, not looking back at her. 2-second fix, don't worry about it." "So, nothing's going wrong?" I ran my finger along the garish spines. There were only about 30 books in McKeown's entire canon, but the shelves had been supplied with every book in every edition, format, box set and special edition re-release, with the searing attention to detail of a true psychotic fan. "Nah," I said. There was a surge of energy, and I felt a stifling heat on one side of my body, as if someone had opened the door of a preheated oven. Instinctively, I dived away from it, landing on my back in time to see a sphere of amplified blaster energy splatter across the Quantanal booth in the corner. The last few tendrils of orange-white energy slithered inside the booth's control panel. It gave a little electronic belch, and then hot slag began to drool from around the screws and the gaps between keys. I looked at Warden. She was holding my blaster outstretched, her mouth tight and determined. I could see that the gun was on the now potentially ironically named "Solve All Immediate Problems" setting. Both she and I flinched as she fired again, the shot melting one of the upper corners at the Quantanal booth's shuttered doorway and ensuring its permanent uselessness. "How about now?" she asked coolly. Chapter 13. I was still lying on my back by the bookshelf, propped up on my elbows. On instinct, I made an attempt to quickly move into a standing position, which was immediately aborted when I found myself staring down the barrel of my own gun. Not for the first time, but on this occasion someone else was holding it. "What are you doing?" I asked, displaying my palms and trying not to sound too interrogative. "I'm making a career change," she said. "I'm going to kidnap Daniel and Jemima, and you are going to help me." Her voice was the same as always, condescending and professional, but the end of the gun was shaking, and I could see lines of sweat escaping from her hairline. I hoped she hadn't gone insane. I could always handle sane people. Sane people are predictable. It's practically the definition of the word. I was about to ask why she was doing this, but that seemed like a fatuous question. "Is this about being made a divisional head? I am not going to end up like Brian Pritchard. I will not allow myself to be filed away until Henderson needs another scapegoat. Stand up." I did so, keeping my hands where she could see them. She was smart enough to stay a good 2 arm lengths away, keeping the gun trained on me. "Okay, so what exactly is your plan from this point?" She moved to the door and gestured with the gun, instructing me to head through it. "You will fly this ship to an area outside planetary surveillance and make contact with a pirate organization cognizant enough to deal with that can be trusted to take us in and shelter us from the authorities and from Henderson." I walked the hallways as slowly as I felt I could get away with, but she didn't take the bait. She didn't try to hasten me by jabbing me with the barrel. She kept the gun out of my grabbing range and matched my speed. Together we shuffled along the expensive carpet like a pair of slugs negotiating the floor of a salt factory. "You know, you'll laugh when you hear this," I said, hopefully, "but I was actually planning to do something along the same lines." "Yes, McKeown, I am fully aware of that, so all you have to do now is continue according to that plan, with the slight modification that we are now partners in the crime." I stopped and turned on my heel, and she promptly froze, hand tightening on the gun. "So you don't have to keep pointing the gun at me," I said, exasperated. "We're on the same page, right?" "That will remain to be seen," replied Warden, gun unmoved. "Proceed to the bridge." I got halfway through turning around again, then stopped. "We don't need the kids. We can just drop them off when they're finished sightseeing and make for the black. Then it's barely even a crime." Don't be dense, McKeown. Henderson would have us blasted out of the sky for disloyalty alone. While we have his son, we have leverage. We can release them as soon as we are out of Henderson's reach.
All right, so maybe we're not on the same page.
What do you mean, release them? So we'll cut them loose as soon as we're in the middle of the black and give them 20 euro yen for the rickshaw home, will we? You're good at improvising. I'll let you come up with something. By this point, we were outside the door to the bridge, and from the other side I could hear scrips and scraps of the most stilted and awkward conversation in the history of courtship. I turned around, keeping my back to the door, and was pinned into place by the gun, still aimed squarely at my chest. Once we go through this door, there's no turning back, I advised. There'll be no more chances to change your mind. You know perfectly well we could do this without bringing the kids into it. But when we go in there and tell Daniel that he's being kidnapped, Henderson will be after us both for the rest of our lives. Hints of emotion rippled across her face. A twitch of an eyebrow here, a wobble of the corner of the mouth there. She took a deep breath and all was stone again. Henderson is not all-powerful. Until recently, I thought that he was. I'd never seen any scheme of his not go entirely according to his desires. She paused lengthily. She was either meditating on the thought or waiting for my prompt. And then what? Her eyes narrowed. And then I saw him swallow that a two-bit out-of-work star pilot could actually be Jacques McKeown. All right, I sighed. Fine. He didn't have to make personal comments. And you can be the one to tell them then, since you're insisting. Fine. She jiggled the gun barrel. Open the door. I turned around and did so. Daniel was sitting in his captain's chair, and Jemima was standing nearby, leaning on his console with arms folded. As we entered, they both boggled at us like deer in headlights.
"Whoa, is that a gun?"
asked Daniel, pertinently.
"What's going on?"
asked Jemima. Her hands gestured uncertainly behind her.
I'm supposed to be back home."
I looked back at Warden, gathering my hands behind me, looking at her with polite expectation. Bits of her face were quivering again, as if every individual muscle was taking part in a heated debate over whether this was still a good idea. Well, I said, isn't there something you'd like to tell our passengers? Maybe I shouldn't have needled her. Her scowl hardened with determination. Daniel, Jemima, she said, I am kidnapping you. Remain calm and make no attempt to resist, and you will be returned unharmed to your families in due time. The kids maintained their boggle-eyed looks as if she hadn't said anything at all. Then Daniel smacked both his hands over his eyes with what sounded like quite injurious force, and he emitted the same "Ugh!" sound he'd made at the dinner, which, with all the ways he could have responded, was frankly not the one I would have put money on.
What?
Jemima asked him.
My dad is so embarrassing, he wailed. He's making Miss Warden pretend to kidnap us because he wants to make it exciting. Ugh, he's always interfering.
Your dad is really weird, said Jemima.
I leaned toward an unmoving Warden and whispered as close to her ear as the gun would allow. Seems like I was wrong back there when I said that was your last chance to back out. Her face flashed thunder at me. Teasing her probably wasn't doing me any favours, but I was tired, and letting pragmatism have a rest while spite had a go on the steering wheel. I assure you, she declared to the kids, this is not an act. Take your phones out, turn them off, and give them to me. To me, she said, get into the pilot's seat. Set a course. I shrugged and made my way around the perimeter of the bridge to the pilot console, as Jemima in the centre watched, worried, rotating like a lighthouse. Do you have any specific guidelines for what direction to take? I said, swiping onto the navigation map. Just get us out of system surveillance, ordered Warden, placing a hand on my chair's backrest while trying to keep the gun trained on both of the kids at once. Then make for the pirate base you think best suited for our needs. I rubbed my chin as I inspected the poorly detailed representation of what was colloquially referred to as the Black, the portion of known space that fell outside the policed zones surrounding the solar system and every other major human settlement. a significantly large majority of the galaxy that only I and my peers were willing to attempt to cross without quantumling. And our needs are to find a pirate clan that won't immediately strip us for parts the moment we show up in a glittering bonanza yacht, I said, partly to myself. Yes, Mr. McKeown, that adequately describes our needs. Den and Mark would probably be the best bet, I thought. Our relationship was based on mutual dislike, but they technically owed me one. Right then, I muttered, plotting a course for the asteroid belt near Cantrabarjid. Warden leaned over my shoulder, watching my inputs carefully.
Hi,
said Jemima, directly behind us. Warden spun and pointed my gun at her. Jemima cringed apologetically, holding out a smartphone in a pink case that matched her hair.
Sorry, said Jemima. Here's my phone, but, hey, if this is something Mr. Henderson arranged, could we do it, you know, some other time? Only I didn't tell my mum.
Warden sighed like a housewife whose nervous dog was terrified of the vacuum cleaner and took the phone. I'm afraid I do not care about how your mother feels about it, Jemima. Mr. Henderson did not organize this, and I am actually kidnapping you.
She says she's actually kidnapping us, called Jemima back to Daniel.
Well, she isn't, said Daniel stubbornly. It's my stupid dad.
Warden stood politely still as Jemima held her chin, frowned, and scrutinized Warden and the gun.
Are you sure? I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing that tends to happen with, you know, people who work for your dad.
No, it's totally my dad.
But can you be sure?
Yeah, 'cause he's telling me so.
There was an audible snap sound as Warden and I both whipped our necks around to look at Daniel. He was holding a slim, expensive phone to his ear and listening with eyes rolled heavenward. Warden's face, already pale from a lifetime of staying in doing administration, turned the colour of an unpainted papier-mâché project. Then she moved with the suddenness of a jumping spider, launching herself at Daniel's phone. She misjudged the height of the metallic railing around the captain's chair and face-planted into the deep pile carpet. Her head rose after an embarrassed second of stillness to meet the gaze of a startled Daniel, who was almost leaning far enough back in his chair to turn himself two-dimensional. He held out his phone toward Warden.
He wants to talk to you?
And then she was on her feet again. It was that fast. There was no messy struggling to get the limbs into place. She simply zipped upright. There was maybe the briefest glimpse of a transitionary phase, during which she appeared to be in the fetal position about 1 foot off the floor, and then she was standing, smoothing down the creases in her business attire. All eyes were on her as she took the phone, and, her hand shaking almost imperceptibly, held it to her ear. Yes, she said, after listening for a few tense moments. Yes, she added, gaining confidence. Yes, she clarified. Her conversation with Henderson continued in this rather monotonous fashion until she suddenly glanced at me. Yes, she reiterated thoughtfully. She offered the phone. He wants to talk to you. Her complexion was far beyond merely pale. She looked like all her blood had been replaced with correctional fluid. I took the phone from a hand resembling a bunch of cold chicken bones in a surgical glove. I took the phone and felt a little spark of hope. Warden was weakened, dividing her attention between too many factors. Perhaps this was the opportunity to throw her back into the clutches of the bear while I made a run for it. I brought the phone to my ear. I already told him we're working together on this, said Warden, apparently reading the look on my face.
Hello, Jack, came Mr. Henderson's voice, dangerously level. How is Daniel's trip going?